Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that we got going on over there. While you're over on the site, check out the events page. We got city events coming up in Houston and Las Vegas. February 22nd in Houston. St. Mark, Houston. That's the church. We'll be out there at Matt Popovitz's place. I'll be there. Chad will be there. Scott Keith, Loso, Gretchen Ronovic, talking about what happens when people encounter Jesus. We're going to see some of that in today's episode, but we're going to talk, do some talks about this, and it's a free event. All you got to do is register and then show up, so get all the information over there. I'll put a link in the show notes. Also in the show notes will be a link to the Las Vegas event. Yeah, that's right. We're going to be in Sin City, talking about the Book of Galatians. Eric will be there, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, Cindy Koch, Blake Flatley, and myself, going through the whole book. That is on March 21st. We'd love to see you there. Again, just sign up, show up. That's how it works. You can get all the information on the site. Eric, happy 2020, Dan. Man.
Yeah, man, the year goes by. The year goes by oh so fast. 2020. So far, so good. You know, we're 5 days in. I'm doing okay, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I was just reading an article where they said that I need to write 2020 on all my documents.
Yeah, that's what I've been told too, but I don't know why.
It's because they say that you could add someone, if you put just 20, someone could add 19 or 18 or something on the end of it.
Oh, yes, gotcha.
But I'm also like, for what purpose?
That's what I'm still not clear on that. But one of our listeners, I'm sure, can tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that someone could do that. I don't know why that or what advantage there would be to doing such a thing. But I guess if you just really wanted to mess with someone, you could change the date on some document by adding another number behind that 20. But
you could.
So much distrust.
There's so much discord and distrust. So we're in Luke chapter 8, verse 40 today. We've been, you know, I wouldn't say that we're like cruising super fast through Luke, but you know, we're moving at a pretty good pace. I think we've been able to spend a good amount of time on each passage that we've gone through and have covered it thoroughly enough without overdoing it. So I'm happy with where we're at right now.
Yeah, it's not a crawl. I think it's the right clip.
Yeah, it's a jog through scripture. Yeah. Nice jog through scripture. All right, so we'll pick it up. Verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying. So note, the synagogue ruler means he's a Jewish man, a Jewish man of influence that has come to ask Jesus for help. So just to point out, you know, oftentimes it seems as if all of the Jewish leadership is sort of anti-Jesus. But that's not the case, and Jairus is an example of that here. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him, and there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. Then Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowds surround you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace."
This is a weird story, man, because Jesus is on his way to do something else,
mm-hmm.
and a woman reaches out, touches him, and then Jesus says, "Who touched me?" And Peter is like, "Are you serious right now?" There's like
all the people.
There's a ton of people here. It'd be like if you're working your way through a crowd, and you're like, "Who touched me?" I mean, like, and you're being touched all over the place. Like you're rubbing shoulders mm-hmm. with everybody.
Yeah.
So this is a very strange situation, but Jesus knows that someone touched him, believing for a certain thing.
Yeah, he recognizes the touch of faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty astounding.
That's what's going on here, that he senses her faith through the touching of his garment.
perceiving that something has gone out of him, the power has left him, mm-hmm. and done something. I mean, this is a weird thing. I mean, really, without this story, you wouldn't know that it worked like that physically for Jesus, but that he actually feels something go from him to the person.
Yeah.
And now this has implications when we're talking about the assumption of things and then the imputation of things. Mm-hmm. But this is how the ministry of Jesus works, where he takes things from people, primarily sins, but also infirmities and sicknesses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he gives them something, and it's an actual something that he has, the power that he has, or the righteousness that he has, all of these things, that this healing and this power flow from him to the person.
I think it's important to point out, just a reminder, the fact that she had a discharge of blood for 12 years means that she was seen as ceremonially unclean for 12 years. And so this is a woman who had been away from the fellowship of God's people for quite some time. This wasn't a woman that was in the inner circle of, you know, the religious people. This is maybe the precise opposite of the synagogue ruler, for that matter. Synagogue ruler is as inside as you get. And here's a woman desperate with no other means of help. I mean, it says that she spent all of her money on physicians and none of them could do anything for her. I mean, she's used up all her deductible and then some. I mean, or, you know, she just can't pay off the deductible in this case. And none of it's worked for her. And so she reaches out in desperate faith, and Jesus will not let the situation go. It's interesting that he decides to stop and find her. You get this sense again that Jesus wants this personal, relational element with her, because he didn't need to know who it was. There is no reason for him to know who it was, except for her to know that he notices her.
Yeah, I mean,
and so that last word, daughter, your faith has made you well, to address her as daughter. Such an intimate term, and then to say go in peace is really, that's the reason why Jesus stops. He wants to make it as personal as he can for her.
Yeah, and the contrast is obviously pretty evident if you read it all together, that yes, Jesus is on his way to go help someone who is obviously in the religious community, that is in, you know, the church of the day, and on the way, he is confronted with this person who is outside of the church, who is not able to go to the synagogue and this sort of thing. And this is part of the reason you have to assume that she is so scared. I mean, it says that she was terrified.
Yeah.
She's trembling.
Yeah, because
right?
she's not in the inner circle, and so she thinks she's done something wrong. Now, let's just, as we move on here, it says, while he was still speaking, verse 49, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." Now, I just want to pause here and think about this, trying to picture yourself being the synagogue ruler as all this is going down. Jesus is on his way to heal your daughter. Like, he's on his way to help you. And then this woman comes, and Jesus takes the time away from his daughter to help this woman. I mean, at least at this very moment, I could see the synagogue ruler going, "Why did you stop? Like, why did you need to know? Now my daughter's dead. Now I could see somebody having that reaction. Like, we didn't have the time to stop. We didn't have the time for you to talk to her. But because you took the time.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, the contrast too. Like, she's not about to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Here, I mean, mine was the more urgent Jesus. I mean, I could certainly just see those kinds of thoughts popping up in this man's head. Now, we don't know that those thoughts came up, but I just think about the way we sort of react to things like this. I could see that being a very rational thought on his part. But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James, his inner circle, and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her, but he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened.
So this instruction, do not fear, only believe, and she will be well. I mean, are we to believe that this is what this guy did? That he was just like not afraid at all, and all he did in that moment was believe.
I have to believe that what this guy did or what this guy felt was the same thing that one other father felt when he said, I believe, help my unbelief.
Yes.
Well, I have to believe there's a huge wrestling match going on internally in this man's soul.
Oh, I imagine. I mean, it says that her parents were amazed.
Yeah, so they weren't like, of course.
They're like, see? Knew it. No, but think about this, these words. You can read these as law if you want, if you want to say that, do not fear, only believe. You're like, I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah.
Or you could probably get the tone correct, which is probably, Jesus is probably not saying, I don't want you being afraid, just believe. I don't think that's probably how he was doing it. I think what he's doing here is fear. I mean, this is the most terrifying thing that you can think of as a parent. This is like your worst nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
So much fear. Mm-hmm. And what Jesus is saying is, you don't need to be afraid. Just believe in me. What Jesus is trying to do is comfort, not give this man something to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when Jesus says, do not be anxious about anything, and gives a bunch of examples as to why we shouldn't be anxious. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that preached in such a way that it's like, don't be anxious. And if you are anxious, then you're guilty of sin. You're like, no, that's not the tone that Jesus has. The whole point of do not be anxious is like, look, I've got you. I've got you. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus is saying it in a reassuring way. So therefore, you don't have to worry. You don't have to be anxious. You're not going to add a single hour to your life. It's okay. That's a totally different way of saying it than like, don't worry. Don't worry or else, you know.
Well, I mean, in this situation, when he says, do not fear, only believe, to say don't be afraid, you have to give them a reason to not be afraid.
Yeah.
And he is the reason. So believe in me. This is the reason that you don't need to be afraid. So replace that fear with the knowledge that I am able to do something about this.
And what did the synagogue ruler just witness? If he needed just a little reassurance that Jesus was capable of doing something for his daughter, he just did see this woman that Jesus healed, and it happened right in front of his eyes. And so you know, he's got reason to believe that Jesus can do what needs to be done here.
Yeah, and then you have Jesus doing classic Jesus move. She's not dead. She's sleeping.
Yeah.
Jesus, who refers to death always as sleep.
Yeah. And that's because that's why we put rest in, that's why we say rest in peace.
Well, did you know this? Chad enlightened me on this. The word cemetery, it actually means sleeping place.
Yes. I am aware of this.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful picture. And it's the reason why, you know, RIP is said so often. So, you know, rest, because you're essentially, the way Paul talks about it, Jesus talks about it, when we die, it's as if we're asleep in the Lord, and then we will one day, you know, our bodies will be raised, you know, and we will stand before the Lord. But it's just sleep. We're going to sleep.
Yep. Yeah. And so what's the response to this, though? Laughter, mocking.
Yeah. Laughter, cynicism. And it's the response, you know, it's the natural response of the human heart to anything that God says, is to disbelieve, is to mock and reject. The natural disposition is to go, you don't know what you're talking about. I know better than you, God. This crowd thinks they know better. But Jesus, of course, has the final word. And of course, the tenderness, you can't go through this passage without seeing how tender Jesus is, takes her by the hand. Again, Jesus doesn't need to touch. He doesn't need to. He can just speak. He chooses to, because Jesus has this intimate connection with his creation and with those made in his image. And so whether it be lepers or, in this case, a dead child, he touches her by the hand and then calls, saying, child, arise.
Yeah, you have two instances of touch in this you know, story. One where a woman reaches out and touches Jesus, and he knows it. And then you also have Jesus reaching out and touching the person who cannot come and reach out and touch him, and this dead child, and touches her. And in both times, they are restored.
So it's a great story, a beautiful story of healing and restoration. We now move into chapter 9. And he called the 12 together and gave them power and authority over all demons and to cure diseases. And he sent them out to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal. And he said to them, take nothing for your journey, no staff, nor bag, nor bread, nor money, and do not have two tunics. And whatever house you enter, stay there and from there depart. And wherever they do not receive you, when you leave that town, shake off the dust from your feet as a testimony against them. And they departed and went through the villages, preaching the gospel and healing everywhere. All right, so first thing that jumps out at me here, Dan, about this initial mission that the 12 apostles are sent on. When they are sent, they are not merely sent preaching, nor are they merely sent healing. They are sent doing both. This is what mission at its very fundamental level actually looks like. It's a both and kind of thing. When we go to the world, we are not merely proclaiming, but we are also a healing presence for the people in our midst. And we're not merely healing, but we're preaching. You know, of course, we see, you know, mission agencies or what started off as maybe relief agencies, those kinds of things, tending to fall on one side or the other in a lot of cases. You know, in our world, you know, you have some agencies that are so focused on preaching or some of outreach groups that are so focused on preaching that they don't tend to think too much about the, you know, basic needs of the people they're preaching to. You've got the other side of the story where people are only focused on the basic sort of temporal needs and they don't preach. But the mission of Jesus has both of these things.
Yeah, I mean, you see this throughout the early church too. I mean, there is care given for those around them, but it is always also accompanied with the message of the gospel, the forgiveness of sins. And so, yeah, these things are always going on in tandem.
And then the way he sent them out, you know, it might seem strange to us, you know, where he says, take nothing for your journey, no staff, no bag, nor bread, nor money, and do not have two tunics. Some have read a lot into this. I would simply say that Jesus is, number one, this is just an awareness that this is going to be a short-term mission trip, that this is unique to the apostles in particular. So we ought not take this as a directive for the way we do missions today, you know, like, hey, you don't have to take anything. Everything will be provided for you when you're there. That's not the way that it tends to work in our time. This is a specific directive to the apostles at this time for this mission.
Now, when they go, this like going in and then if they reject you, shake the dust off your feet. This is more to that point that you were making, that this is a short-term thing. They're just hitting town to town. And
yeah, there's an urgency to this.
Yeah, they're not going to sit around and stay in one place if that place doesn't want them there.
Yeah. And, you know, don't read too much into that. I mean, you know, there's a tendency to read this and go, okay, so this means that, you know, I can shake the dust off my feet towards anybody who doesn't receive the gospel I'm preaching, and I don't have to worry about preaching to them ever again or sharing the faith of them ever again. I wouldn't take it that literal and that far. I mean, this is specific directive to the apostles at that time. If you do want to sort of drag a principle out of this, I think it is fair to say that, yes, there is a time where if somebody says, like, listen, I don't want to hear what you're trying to share with me, well, then don't kick against the goads. Don't force, you know, you're not going to force their ears to receive what they don't want to receive. And, you know, have enough respect for them to walk away.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. It certainly happened to me, you know, doing this in New York City, you learn to deal with the rejection of people that are saying, no, thanks. I don't want it.
Yeah.
And so when I shake the dust off, I'm not shaking the dust off like, I hate you. And, you know, I'm not angry at them. I just recognize, okay, it's time to leave.
Yeah. It's also the realization that you can't save anybody.
That's right.
I mean,
yeah.
you literally cannot, no matter how much evidence you provide or reasonable arguments you make, you cannot make anyone believe.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that can be a hard pill to swallow for us, because of course, as human beings, we like We love the illusion of control. And now we move on to verse 7. Now Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was happening, and he was perplexed, because it was said by some that John had been raised from the dead, by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the prophets of old had risen. Herod said, John I beheaded, but who is this about whom I hear such things? And he sought to see him. You know, when I read the word perplexed here, I read it in a way that suggests, like, really nervous.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, different time, different place. So a lot of things coming, you know, by word of mouth. Mm-hmm. A lot of hubbub going on, but no one's got pictures. You know, mm-hmm. no one's texting you a photo like, you should got to meet this guy. You got to hear this guy. He's just hearing somebody talking about repenting and believing, and he's doing mighty works. And then he's saying, maybe he's heard he said positive things about John, or people that used to follow John are now following this guy. One of the first things he's nervous about is, did this guy come back from the dead? Did the guy whose head I chop off come back from the dead? Because here's the thing. If you're responsible for cutting someone's head off, and then you think that person is back from the dead, you may think that you're not on their list of favorite people. And someone coming back from the dead is a nerve-wracking thing if you think that they have a vendetta against you.
How many movies have been made with such premises?
Yes. So he's nervous about that. You know, he's also hearing like, oh, no, it's not that. It's like a prophet. He just knows that somebody is creating a stir, and apparently this person has some power.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, to see Herod's response to Jesus throughout the narrative in Luke. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, you know, in like chapter 13, it seems that he's ready to kill Jesus. And yet after Jesus is arrested and, you know, he's sent to him, you know, we find out that Herod wants him to be brought to him to see him do a miracle. Mm-hmm. You know, he's intrigued by Jesus, but is also very, very threatened by Jesus, as literally the entire line of the Herodians are. From the very beginning of his life, because if he is really the king of the Jews, well, then that means that, you know, the Herod family is going to be out of a job.
Right.
And so we pick it up at one of Jesus's most famous miracles on their return. So the return from their mission trip, the apostles told him all that they had done, and he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. When the crowds learned it, they followed him, and he welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God and cured those who had need of healing. Now the day began to wear away, and the 12 came and said to him, send the crowd away to go into the surrounding villages and countryside to find lodging and get provisions, for we are here in a desolate place. But he said to them, you give them something to eat. They said, we have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we are to go and buy food for all these people. For there were about 5,000 men. And he said to his disciples, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. And they did so and had them all sit down. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing over them. Then he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the crowd. And they all ate and were satisfied. And what was left over was picked up 12 baskets of broken pieces. Well, there you have it. One of Jesus's most famous miracles. What do we make of this, Dan?
Well, first, you have a large group of people following Jesus. So if you want to know why Herod is perplexed, I don't know. He's got like 5,000 people listening to him.
And that's just men. Just 5,000 men. Yeah.
Who knows how big this crowd is? But that's a big enough crowd. I mean, that even today, if someone was wandering around drawing crowds of 5,000 at a time, 5,000 plus at a time, people would be like, man, this guy's really creating quite a following.
Yeah, so, that would get the notice of government officials.
Yeah, so it's not surprising that Herod's like noticing what Jesus is doing. But here they are. They withdraw out into what the disciples call a desolate place.
Well, that's not unfamiliar terminology in the scripture.
No. So he is out in a desolate place, and the disciples are like, look, you got to send these people out of here. It's getting late. They haven't had anything to eat all day. Like, you got to tell them to go lodge somewhere, go find some food, and I love that he says to them, you give them something to eat.
Jesus. You can see how incredulous they are towards that suggestion.
Yeah, Jesus is can be a little trolly sometimes. Like, what is he talking about? I mean, don't beat up on the disciples too much. I mean, you have 5,000 plus people out there, and then some guy's like, hey, why don't you get these guys something to eat? You'd be like, what?
Yeah. Five loaves and two fish. This is what we got.
Like, five loaves and two fish isn't enough for the 12 of them.
Yeah.
Never mind all this. So he tells him that that's what he's got, and he says, hey, give it to me. Sit them down in groups of 50 and watch this. And so Jesus has, you know, one of his ultimate hold my beer moments and blesses this. And how this works, you have no idea.
No. I try to picture this and just this sort of continually multiplying in his hands sort of, you know, picture comes to my mind, but you know, it's a very strange passage.
It is. I mean, like, I think maybe the best depiction of this is there's a mini series back in the day called Jesus of Nazareth. And they have, you know, the fish and the loaves in a basket. And they're just, and they do a good job because you could tell the disciples, like, this is just ridiculous. Yeah. So he walks out there, there's all these people, and he's got this basket with five loaves and two fishes in it. Mm-hmm. He's like, there's not a lot. And like, people start reaching and grabbing it, and they're like, what are you talking about? There's just tons of it in there.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Now, did it happen that way? I don't know. But somehow, like, that just, this stuff just never ran out.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, in case you know, there has been, I don't know if in, you know, I would say recent times, but in more modernistic interpretations of this passage, there's been the suggestion that the lesson here was actually not that there was a miracle, but the miracle, there wasn't like loaves and loaves and loaves being multiplied, but it was just that with the little they had, the miracle that happened is everybody just took a tiny, 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 tiny bit and shared with all the other people there, and that was what satisfied them. That is a little bit too much of a stretch for us here, folks, especially considering, I mean, if you have a hard time accepting a miracle like this, then you really kind of have a hard time with the, you know, everything else we've just read about him raising a little girl from the dead,
yeah.
You know, about him stopping this woman's issue of bleeding. I mean, you know, if Jesus can do that stuff, I have no problem believing that Jesus can, you know, has the power and the blessing from the Father to do this with the bread.
I heard a guy once say that exact thing, like the miracles that they were satisfied with sharing. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like,
that's not, I mean, that many people, it would be the smallest of crumbs.
Well, I just said to him, oh, yeah. How do you account for 12 baskets of leftovers then? Which is... Sounds like these people were getting after it.
Yeah. And of course, the 12 baskets of leftovers, most likely, although it doesn't say it specifically in the text, it's a basket for each disciple.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, so I don't think that interpretation works when you...
No. When you read the whole passage?
Nah, yeah, it doesn't work. And you know, the point of this is that Jesus provides nourishment for people in a desolate place where they have no way of providing for themselves.
He provides the bread of life.
Yes. And so if you want to know really what this is about, is that Jesus provides food, literally something to eat for people in a place where there is nothing. And you know, he still does this, that he still provides for us. This is why we ask God to give us our daily bread, and we ask him to provide for us. He still does this for us spiritually, but yet physically, every week at the Lord's table, where we find ourselves in the desolate place of a sin-riddled world, and he provides us bread to eat. And
every week in the desolation of New York City, Jesus provides his body and blood in the form of bread and wine to the members of the church that gathers in that city.
Yeah, the desolate place is exactly where Jesus is going to do some work.
Yeah.
And that's it, man. Right. We are out of time. That is 30 minutes. Guys, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so. Get the year started off right. Become a contributor. You just go over to the donate page at 1517, and you can do that. Thank you so much to all of you who make this show and everything that we do at 1517 possible. Eric, I will see you next week.
Sounds good.